Hello, and welcome to Jesuitical, a new podcast from the ever more young, borderline hip, and vivaciously lay editors of American Media. That lay part means we aren't Jesuits, but we work with them. Join us each week for a smart Catholic take on faith, culture, and the news, often over drinks. I am Ashley McKinless, and I'm joined by Olga Segura.
Hey, guys.
And Zach Davis.
Hello again.
Hello. So we are transporting ourselves to post 4th of July. But this is being recorded before 4th of July so that we can all... Oh, are you going to bloop bloop again?
That was backwards.
So yes, we wanted to pre-record this because we might be out of town at various beaches and places next week. But we still want to show up in your iTunes feed on next Friday. So, Zach, what are we drinking this 4th of July week?
Well, to celebrate the 4th of July, we've got the King of Beers, which you might think is Budweiser. But no, it's America.
It's America.
So we are drinking America, produced by Budweiser, produced by Russian oligarchs. So.
A pluribus unum.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Who are we talking to? This / next week.
So we're talking to Danny Gustafson, who is a Jesuit regent who teaches at Fordham Prep and is also an editor at the Jesuit Post. So we'll be talking to him about this new survey that came out sort of in advance to next year's Synod on Young People. So we're going to be talking to him about that a little bit.
Yes. So a synod is a gathering of bishops. So in 2014 and 2015, there was the Synod of Bishops on the Family, where they got together to talk about family issues. And in 2018, they're going to be talking about the youths.
The youths.
The youths.
So let me get this straight. Gaggle of geese, Synod of Bishops.
That is correct.
Okay, got it.
And so just so people who don't live in New York, Fordham Prep is a high school, and the Jesuit Post is published by American Media, and it's a online publication aimed at young adults, and it's all written by young men in Jesuit formation. So that'll be a great talk.
Yeah, sorry, I'm so New York centric. I said Fordham Prep, like, of course everyone knows what that is.
That's quite all right. We are going to have Signs of the Times this week, but it's going to be a little different because
who knows what will happen in the next couple of weeks.
News might happen between now and next week, but we can't predict that. So we're going to talk about the state of the country on this 4th of July, specifically under President Donald Trump. But before we dive into all things Trumpian, what do you guys have planned for the 4th of July weekend?
The meaning of the day is lost upon me, but 4th of July for me is basically every other year I alternate between whatever city I'm living in and going back home to Delaware, Ohio, where the best fireworks in the country are...
Oh, really?
Are produced.
Better than the Washington Mall.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's so sanitized and safe. But so I usually go back and the whole town comes out and it's this very communal thing. You know, it means bonfires and hot dogs and beer and getting together with the community. So that is what the 4th of July means to me.
Wasn't there like a Confederate flag controversy last year?
Who let the one of us without a Confederate flag controversy in their hometown cast the first stone?
Fair. I go to South Carolina every year. Growing up, I would spend my 4th of Julys in South Carolina. We would go to Lake Lure with all my mom's side of the family, and it was wonderful. And our favorite part of the night is when the fireworks are going. All 20 cousins sing Proud to Be an American, and it's great. What about you, Olga?
Mine is very similar to what Zach was mentioning. My family gets together. We do this whole, like, this really big communal barbecue up in the Bronx, and we just eat a lot of food. Not really hot dogs and stuff, because for Dominicans, we just repeat a lot of what we do for Thanksgiving and Christmas. So it's a lot of chicken, a lot of pork, really large portions. But
there's some of that in hot dogs, I think.
So we just get together, we eat and we celebrate, listen to a lot of merengue music. And it's just like a really communal, fun time, you know, and it's kind of like the only time of year aside from the other two holidays where my family actually gets together when it's not freezing outside. So it's, yeah.
Nice.
So
will things be different now that we have a president who's promised to make America great again? Will this be the best 4th of July ever?
I mean, like I said, the holiday for me is like totally devoid of any type of like national spiritual significance.
Yeah.
For good or for ill.
Speaking of which,
yes.
You wrote a article for America about national spiritual significance.
Yeah. Nice segue.
Thank you. So your article is called Donald Trump's Sins Are Our Sins Too, and Impeachment Won't Absolve Them.
Yeah. So when I was writing this piece.
Do explain.
Yeah. Basically, I was noticing that a lot of people, especially with the Comey testimony and.
Comey is what?
Former director of the FBI who was fired by President Trump. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are hoping that this will prove collusion with Russian officials so that we can impeach Donald Trump and
everything will be solved.
And everything will be solved. And what I was trying to point out was that this obsession with impeachment is a form of escapism a little bit because Donald Trump is in fact 100% American and produced by us and our structures and our history and trends. So failure to reckon with that and sort of just push him off as a scapegoat and impeaching him is problematic.
Yeah, and this is partly in response to people who are, there was right after he was elected, like, not our president. So you're saying he is your president.
Yeah, he's totally our president. He's my president. Yeah. He's your president. He's our president.
Can I just read your opening paragraph?
Sure.
You say, I confess to Almighty God and to you, my brothers and sisters, that I have greatly sinned. I dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. I aborted the fetus with Down syndrome. I took away the coal miners' health insurance. I pushed for higher sentencing requirements. I blocked the refugee. I deported the undocumented. Wow, Zach. It's pretty messed up.
I know. I've done some rough stuff in my life, but...
So, yeah. So, what is the connection between how you see the politics of this and the Catholic... like conception of sin.
Yeah, it's, I confess it, but I say it with the community, in front of the community, and I ask for absolution and with the community. And, you know, even the most innocent among us, babies, are still born with the sin of Adam and Eve, is something we all teach. So we all share. There's no such thing as a private sin.
Yeah, and I think one line that I really found interesting in your piece is Americans have long believed in the myth of our exceptionalism. And I think That's where a lot of the he's not my president is coming from, because I think a lot of people want to think that Trump just came out of nowhere and America has always been this wonderful nation where we've always done these really fantastic things. But it's, you know, if we look back all throughout history for people of color, Native Americans, you know, we have always had awful moments in history. And I think it's easier to point the finger and to just say like, no, I didn't vote for him. I have nothing to do with this. But that's not true.
Yeah, and, you know, just as Christians share the sin of our first parents, Americans share in the original sins of our country. You know, as a white male, I can't exist without all of the privileges that come with that. And similarly, as an American, you can't exist in the structures that exist here without also existing in the same structures that, you know, produced slavery and internment camps and redlining and extermination of Native Americans. And because of that, we all live here and we all participate in those. And we have to acknowledge that. I mean, don't get me wrong. I would fully support getting his hands off the nuclear codes. So I don't want this to come across as
defense of Trump.
Right. But, you know, you're not off the hook just because you didn't vote for him, mm-hmm. is what I would say. We typically say welcome back. I haven't done this part in a while.
We usually say, and now we're joined by.
All right. Well.
All right. That's why we usually say.
Yeah.
And now
I'm second guessing myself.
And now we are pleased to welcome Danny Gustafson, who is a Jesuit regent working at Fordham Prep. What are you teaching there?
Religion. I've got freshmen and juniors and next year freshmen and seniors.
All right. Great. So you're teaching them and you're also editor at large at the Jesuit Post.
That's right.
Published by American Media.
Published by American Media. Editor on the run.
Yeah, welcome to Jesuitical, Danny.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Great to have you here. So one of our listeners, Katie Sampius, suggested that we all take the survey that the Vatican has put out ahead of it's called the Synod of Bishops on Youth and Vocation. So all the bishops are going to get together in Rome and talk about us youths.
The youths.
And so ahead of this, they wanted to get an idea of what the youths are thinking these days. So we all took the survey, and we thought that you would be a perfect person to talk about it with because you work with young people at Fordham Prep, and the TJP is geared towards young adult Catholics. So did you take the survey?
I did.
Okay. And
so did all of us.
Yes, yeah, we all took the survey.
The thing I thought was interesting is it seemed mostly almost sociological in what it was asking.
Exactly.
Right? Which...
Yeah, it had questions about work and school and...
Like, when you moved out.
Yeah.
If you've moved out, do you have kids? It was almost like a census of sorts, but not even for Catholics. It seemed like it was geared towards, if anything, people who aren't practicing right now, which I thought was super interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, even the question about religious beliefs that, you know, do you practice faith tradition? If so, what is it? And the first one was, I'm Catholic, but then it was, I'm Catholic, but not practicing. I'm Christian, but not Catholic. I'm Christian, not Catholic, not practicing. I believe in a higher being. So the options were totally open to really any background.
Mm-hmm. And I'm actually writing an article for America on young adult ministry in the United States, an upcoming in advance of this synod. And one of the things that I found in talking to people is that I think the Vatican is more interested in hearing from people who aren't involved anymore. Who are kind of on the peripheries right now. And the survey reflected that.
Yeah, for sure. So maybe we can just start talking about some of the questions that I thought were particularly interesting. One of them had to do with what persons or institutions had the most influence on you and your faith life. So how did you guys answer that question?
I think one of the ones I picked was universities. Like, it was just such a part of my upbringing and my education that I really didn't think of how much it's affected me until I'm looking at the survey right now as a 27-year-old. And I'm just like, wow, my entire sense of right and wrong, my values, everything have been influenced by Catholic education and just sort of Catholic social teaching. So that stood out to me personally. How about you guys?
I put a lot of my teachers and, you know, professors were really important to me. And so being, you know, and I didn't go to Catholic school until I went to Loyola Chicago, and that was my first experience of Catholic education. But even then, you know, it wasn't necessarily teachers who were invested in it because it was a Catholic school. It was just sort of people investing in me and supporting me and, you know, pushing me to do what I was talented at. So that's what I put for the people that have influenced me the most.
Yeah, I was surprised by my answer too, just because now I'm so engaged in the church. I work with the church. But when I was a kid, like, priests and women religious were not a part of my life, really. I went to church, but I was not getting advice from priests. So, like, my answers were, like, soccer coaches and teachers and my parents, of course. But, yeah, given where I am now, the church did not have that much overt influence over me that I can really think about and pinpoint now.
I think the survey was aware of that as well, because at one point they asked about sort of influence or religious practice now, but then said, step back to when you were 17, what was it like then? So I think there's sort of an awareness or a recognition that those things do change as we sort of move from adolescence into young adulthood.
But it's interesting because I also, in addition to, I mean, coaches cut me from the basketball team, so I did not put them as a huge influence on my life.
Influence in different
sense. That's a good point, yeah.
You certainly haven't forgotten.
I opened up the free... My free response was purely venting about that episode.
As any of our listeners will know.
But, you know, I was super involved in a youth group, sort of, and it happened by chance. And so even my decision to go to Loyola was definitely influenced by that. You know, I always think of what my life would have been like had I not gotten involved in that youth group in high school. And it's... The way I imagine it is very much I would have gone to, you know, a public college, studied English, been like antagonistically agnostic probably. Mm-hmm. And my whole life's different because someone invited me to a youth group and I actually got to know a lot of youth ministers and priests that, you know.
Was it a pretty girl?
and a pretty girl.
So Danny, how about what kind of answers would you get from the young people that you work with or the young people that you teach?
I wrote about a couple years ago when I was I went to Philadelphia for the weekend the Pope was in town because a friend of mine who was working at St. Joe's Prep at the time was organizing a pilgrimage there for high schoolers from all over the U.S. and I think Canada, maybe Puerto Rico were invited as well to come and stay at St. Joe's Prep. And we had a conference over a couple of days with the different talks and then breakout sessions and time for praying together in mass and reconciliation service and all of that. And then we went down to the papal events in Philly with all of them. And during the reconciliation service, this friend of mine who was organizing it stepped outside of the church just for a minute. And one of the organizers, one of the student organizers of this event was sitting on the curb just sobbing into his hands. And my friend goes, so-and-so, like, what's going on? And the kid said, I have never experienced God like this before.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Yeah. What do you think are the, with your students, the biggest barriers to faith or feeling like they're a part of the church today?
I think that they don't want to be told what to do or what to believe. So
they're teenagers.
They're teenagers, exactly. Exactly. It's just raging hormones and all kinds of angst. No, I think that they can be taught facts, but I have found them that they're more responsive to me when I'll sort of give them the facts and give them ways to think about those things, but let them put the pieces together and sort of come to the conclusions on their own. And they buy in pretty significantly if they just get a little more space to sort of be adults in some way and choose to claim this or not for themselves and not have me just sort of throw a catechism at them for 40 minutes a day all school year long, but to give them the information certainly and to teach what the church believes, but ultimately let them put the pieces together on their own at some point.
Yeah, that definitely resonates with me. I was raised Catholic, went to mass, but it wasn't until I was in college and didn't have my parents dragging me to mass that my faith really became important to me.
Here's something that I really want to get into is like, what is a young adult really, you know, for the church? I mean, they're one of the most fluid demographics. Young adults can mean student, can mean working, can mean married, can mean
have children of their own.
Children of their own. They could have kids that are 10 years old,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So how do you minister to that demographic? And I think this is seen on the parish level too. No one really knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
Has anyone ever been to a young adult event put on either by their parish or their diocese here?
Yes.
No.
Yeah. So, I mean, right now I think the answer is let's have a theology on tap.
Right.
Right. Yeah. That's basically the only thing people are doing, right? Like give them beer, which is not a bad scenario, but also I don't know if it's working. I think the church needs to shift the way it thinks about young people. Like, I think the danger becomes if young people are zoo animals at the synod, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm also thinking, do young people need to be like targeted as young people or incorporated into the life of the church as just regular, like, I don't know. I feel like the church is like one of the last places where you can like interact with people who aren't your own age. And so maybe it's more important to have a book club that like 22-year-olds and 6-year-olds feel welcome at than to like have a young adult happy hour for, you know, or theology on tap kind of thing.
I mean, that's something I've said in our own parish. Mm-hmm. I don't have any shortage of like drinks with friends in my life. Right. I don't need more of that. So like if someone's like, hey, you know, we're having drinks and social after mass for the young adult group, I'm not going to, and you know, I've got something else to do. I'm not going to feel any guilt whatsoever skipping that. But if someone's like, you know, we're going to do small group faith sharing, and then I'm missing out on someone I have a relationship with and, you know, they're telling me where they're experiencing God in their lives that week. And I'm missing out on that as well. That I think is something, you know, I don't have. You know, now I do here at this podcast, but does that make sense? I don't know.
No, I think it does.
Well, I think a question there is that a way of ministering to young people or is that a way of ministering just to people?
Yeah.
I think these are naturally things that could be incorporated into the overall ministry of a parish or a school or, you know, whatever the community is. But I think these are just good things to be done that might be a particular appeal to young people, but I don't think they're limited to people between the ages of 16 and 29, certainly.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I retweeted this from our Jesuitical account, but someone who was like, me, heck yeah, I'm a pious Catholic who wants more community. Also me, no, I won't join any church groups. Which like really sums up a lot of young people's positions right now. I don't know.
Yep. Yeah,
that's how I feel. It's like, yeah, but also, no thanks.
Yeah.
So Danny, you're a young adult. Clearly you fit within the age range, but you're also a Jesuit. So what experiences as a young person led you to become a Jesuit?
Really, it comes down to the Jesuits I met when I was in college. You know, got to college and thought, all right, I'm free. I'm sort of an adult. I'm on my own now. didn't think I'd keep going to mass, probably. I had, you know, nice enough parish priests growing up, but it was never that meaningful to me. And really, it was the Jesuits' ability to connect what was going on in the gospel with what was going on in current events in the world around me. And that connection was something I sort of always felt was there, but had never really heard teased out in homilies in a big way. And so hearing them do that as a, you know, 18-year-old college freshman was very exciting and affirming and encouraging and helped me see the relevancy of faith in the world around me. And also sort of the personal example of these Jesuits. They're humans. They're regular guys. They're very, very bright professors and scholars. A lot of them had had other careers before entering as lawyers or engineers. One worked in politics. And at first I was sort of confused by, like, why would you walk away from all of those things? Because it was clear that their ultimate priority was ministering to us students and serving Jesus were really their two main priorities, which might be one and the same. And I was sort of confused why, and they're so successful, they've got all these things going for them. It's like, why aren't sort of you yourself a bigger deal in your own mind, which is as much, at least as much about me as about them. But it was sort of their example and sort of their humanness. They were very skilled, very bright, and weren't trying to hide their flaws, you know, if they're sort of, you know, tech nerds or have a big interest in college basketball or whatever, that it's sort of very normal human sorts of interests. And that was inviting, encouraging, appealing to me. So it really comes down to their personal example of being just regular people for whom faith was very important.
All right. Should we move into our last question?
We should.
So I'm sure you know this is coming. We ask all of our guests, if you could canonize one person, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, Catholic or not, if you were given those powers, which we're giving them to you right now.
So we have the power to give you those powers.
Yes. Who's it going to be?
Thought a lot about it. Flannery O'Connor.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
Favorite author.
That hasn't come up yet.
No, I'm surprised. Yeah. You know.
But no, I think her use, I mean, her writing is beautiful. It's challenging. It's a little grating that I find it moving. I don't know if I like it or enjoy it on sort of a surface level, but it's challenging, which I appreciate. And I was rereading a couple of her short stories while I was on retreat last week. And
Which ones?
Revelation was the one I sat with for a while.
Nice.
And her use of the grotesque of sort of who's the ugliest or most repulsive person in the story. And they're likely going to wind up being the voice of God in that story. Challenges me in sort of my own spiritual life and in my own life, sort of day to day. So her ability to sort of find God or present God in the unlikely people is inspirational and challenging in a way that I need.
You've made Mark Bosco very proud. All right, Danny, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Danny.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And good luck with the muse.
Thank you.
All right, now time for some listener feedback. We put out a Twitter poll, looking forward to our conversation with Danny, and we asked, how did you stay attached to your Catholic faith once your parents stopped forcing you to go to Mass? Robert Christian said, switched parishes to evening Mass, popular with teens, with priests who connected faith to daily life, and ruffled some feathers with occasional damn.
just like a typical college professor teaching freshmen. Say a damn word one here and there and show the kid you're cool. Yeah. Next we've got David, who said he got into spiritual reading, James Martin S.J., Merton, Rollheiser, and Rohr.
Next, from Bob Boyle, he writes, I began attending some evangelical Protestant churches, full circle, and back in the Catholic Church now.
Welcome back.
Jinx.
On to consolations and desolations. So for this part of the show, we thought we would maybe offer some reflections on the state of the country right now and look for some bright spots. Yes. So
and on a high note.
Yeah. And on
where
a high note.
Where do we see God working?
Which is totally not a form of escapism.
No.
Looking for good points when everything is bad.
What do you have, Zach?
I would say something that I've seen in the country, you know, just with myself paying attention to things more and friends looking at things more, is that I think feel like people are paying attention to the political process in ways that they aren't before.
The emoluments clause.
Right.
No one knew what that was a year ago.
Right. Thankfully, someone is stepping all over different, you know, constitutional amendments that have become dormant for a while, and we're paying attention to things like this more, and we're listening to daily news podcasts to try and keep up with the pace of current events. Mm-hmm. I don't think I would have been doing that before this, but you know, some of us are team NPR up first, some of us are team The Daily, but
some of us are both.
Yeah, so that's what I would say is, in it's probably good for our civic health that we are paying more attention. I'm sure there are next steps, but that's a good start.
Yeah. What about you, Olga?
So I think one of the places I'm sort of seeing hope is just with all this rhetoric we've seen from this administration on immigrants and the undocumented, seeing various churches across the country just sort of popping up as sanctuary places for the undocumented, that's been really consoling for me. I come from an immigrant family. I'm an immigrant myself, and I have undocumented relatives, and just seeing that regardless of what the government is saying, there are still church communities that are going to be there for these people who are terrified right now, and that feels super hopeful and super consoling.
That's great.
Ashley, what do you got?
So this is ANIC data. That's my favorite kind of data.
That's the only data I trust.
So I think the political situation has caused a lot of people to really crave the grounding that a faith community can give you. A couple of guests on our show, Tracy Wigfield and Scott Detrow, both talked about how just the craziness of first the campaign and then the first few months of the Trump administration has really made Mass a place of like calm and reflection that they really need in the midst of all of that. So I think it's reassuring that people are still turning to the church in a time like this.
It's funny, the church is, you know, I forget who said it, but either afflicting the comfortable or comforting the afflicted.
Yeah.
Yeah. So shall we roll credits?
Wait, can we first say goodbye?
Yes. So,
oh Lord, I don't want to do this. Yeah. I've been in denial about this for quite some time, so I would just rather pretend.
Okay. It's not well, this is the last episode that Wyatt.
Just shut up, Wyatt.
He's in the background trying to get us to not do this, but we have to.
This is the last episode produced by Wyatt Massey. He has been an O'Hare Fellow at American Media for the past year. And this is his last day here, and we are so sad to see him go.
And honestly, like, would not be where we are without you.
Really?
And that's not an understatement or a cliche, but I would look at you if I didn't have to stare at my mic. I mean, you've done everything from make memes to learn audio editing programs to figure out how to hook up mics to give feedback.
Literally everything.
So you've been...
And he was our first, when we were doing pilot episodes, he was our first guest. And that is when we realized, oh, we need to have guests. We can't carry this by ourselves.
We can't just be like
ourselves.
The three of us talking. Yeah. So you have really, I'm not going to turn around because I might start crying, but you have literally been a part of this from the very beginning when we were in like that dark studio in our old office. It was just like us three and Wyatt. I think no one at that point was still taking us super seriously, but Wyatt was there, you know, pushing us forward, and we were going to miss you.
Why you will always be with us in our hearts.
Always.
So he's not dying. He's just moving on.
He's
to
not.
Next
he's
project.
Just moving on. But
so, yeah. Thank you.
You will always be with me in my podcast feed.
Aww.
Oh, thanks.
Oh, my gosh. I said I wouldn't cry.
Don't do it. Actually, I can't. If you start crying, I'm going to start.
All right. Roll those credits, Ashley.
Okay. Jesuitical is brought to you by American Media and produced by Wyatt Massey and Eloise Blondio. Our editor is Noah Levinson. Jesuit formation provided by Eric Sundrup, SJ. Adult supervision provided by Carrie Weber. Research help provided by Emma Winters, Jack McCordick, and Anna Marchese. Our logo is by Sean Tripoli. You can follow us on Twitter at Jesuitical Show and find us on iTunes and leave us a review or find us on Stitcher or wherever else you get your podcast. And you can send us your questions, feedback, cocktail recipes, and tell us where you found God this week at jesuitical@americanmedia.org. It's a little after the 4th, but happy 4th, y'all, and we will see you next week.